Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for April 17, 2003. My name is Doug Henwood and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. I've got a rather special show scheduled for tonight and an unusual one. The entire hour will be devoted to an interview with the renowned philosopher and cultural critic Slavoj Žižek, who generously agreed to an interview when he was in New York this past weekend. Before introducing Žižek, a couple of announcements. First, we've been asked to announce that this station needs volunteers. We pay the bills by relying on the generosity of our listeners, but there's still a lot of work to be done. And since we can't afford a big paid staff, we're asking listeners to pitch in. So if you've got the time and the inclination, there's a volunteers meeting every Friday night from 6 to 9 right here at 120 Wall Street. That's Friday, 6 to 9 at our studios, 120 Wall Street, the street that begins in a graveyard and ends in a river. And second, we're also trying to bring you news headlines at the top of every hour. We haven't gotten all the kinks worked out in this yet, but until we do, I'm going to start doing some newsy economic headlines at the beginning of my show, starting next week. And now to Slavoj Žižek. And for those of you who are not up in your Slovenian spelling, that's S-L-A-V-O-J-Z-I-Z-E-K, with some diacritical marks over the Z's we English speakers often drop. Žižek, based in Ljubljana, Slovenia, is an amazingly prolific and versatile philosopher who applies a mix of psychoanalysis and Marxism to the analysis of politics and culture. Among the many things he's written about are nationalism, anti-Semitism, anti-immigrant feelings, and the films of Alfred Hitchcock. Most of the time on this show, my guests and I look at what's going on in a spirit of truth-telling and unmasking. But that's not always enough. There are stubborn and complex reasons why people believe the things that they do and act the way that they do, and not always rationally or in their own best interests. So I thought it might be interesting to take this theoretical detour. If you find the content or the accent a bit incomprehensible, this show will be up on my website tomorrow, so you can listen again if you like. Follow the radio archive links at leftbusinessobserver.com. That's leftbusinessobserver, all one word, .com. Among Žižek's many books are The Sublime Object of Ideology, published in 1989, which includes a fascinating analysis of nationalism, Tarrying with the Negative, The Plague of Fantasies, The Ticklish Subject, The Fragile Absolute, a completely non-religious defense of the revolutionary heritage of Christianity, Did Somebody Say Totalitarianism, a defense of the revolutionary heritage of Lenin, and Welcome to the Desert of the Real, an essay on 9/11 and terrorism. Slavoj Žižek.
We all saw that image the other day of the statue falling in Baghdad, the statue of Saddam Hussein. The American administration, of course, wanted to make that an iconic image of liberation. The documentary filmmaker Ken Burns said of that sort of image, that we run those images over and over again, what we want to see. And that's the sense of what the repetition is about. What was your analysis of what happened there and its reception?
Very strangely, you know what was my first association? There were another two statues falling down 2 years earlier. You remember the Bamiyan Buddha statues in Afghanistan. And not that I'm implying that the United States are some kind of new Taliban, this game with both are fundamentalists, it's a little bit too easy. Nonetheless, my first ironic comment would have been that if we take statues as such, representing some kind of traditional culture, I claim that not even so much American bombs as the American capitalist model is much more effective destructive force than poor Taliban bombs. My second reaction was, you know, if there is a lesson to be learned from history, from communism 10 years ago, the fall of communism, I mean, is that I have a deep distrust against these enthusiastic moments, even if we abstract from the fact how much this destruction of the statues really represents a large majority of Iraqi people. Here I even tend to agree that yes, probably a relative majority of Iraqis was, to put it modestly, relatively enthusiastic, not for any big ideological reasons, but for the simple fact that, I mean, life was difficult under Saddam, and Probably for an ordinary Iraqi, it will get a little bit better, maybe. So my point is not it's all manipulated. My point is simply that these enthusiastic explosions are just a moment of opening, and what matters to me is the day after. And there I'm a little bit less enthusiastic than it may appear. The first problem, okay, the idea was let's bring democracy to Iraq. I'm not just a simple cynical leftist, haha, look who's saying, but I think a couple of simple facts have to be mentioned here. First, are we aware that for on account of simple geopolitical strategic interests, United States cannot afford democracy in the Middle East now? Of course, United States are well aware that to introduce democracy, and I'm not playing here any Marxist game, some real democracy. By democracy, I simply mean usual Western liberal democracy through multi-party elections, but so on. This would have meant that sooner or later, some kind of, if not fundamentalist, then at least nationalist Arab regime would take over and would at least play some anti-American games with, you know, conditioning oil supply. So that's the first irony of the situation for me. The second one is how open the game is becoming now. For example, the official goal is, okay, bring democracy. But I think that what is so interesting for me is that the ideologists around Bush, Wolfowitz and others, are getting clearer and clearer. For example, William Kristol, whom I quote in many of my essays, openly put it. He said it's not really about Iraq, it's about the role to be recognized, this absolutely hegemonic role of the United States. And another point they are making clearly is best encapsulated by the last book of that, I think he's Bush's favorite columnist in Newsweek, Farid Zakaria, who now openly warns about what he calls over-democratization. His idea is that in the world, as well as in the United States, democracy exploded too much, and that this disturbs the normal run of things. With regard to third world, his focus is on countries who he claims perform best economically now, are successful models of democracy, like Taiwan. His big Trump cards are Taiwan, Chile and, okay, Singapore, some others, South Korea, yes. His idea is that what do these countries have in common is that a decade or two ago they were all military dictatorships. And that his idea is that's a condition. You cannot directly install a democracy. You first have to create economic conditions through a benevolent authoritarian regime. And he is quite open that United States, in its policing it around, should not simply bring democracy to countries, but should install a benevolent authoritarian regime, and then this regime, under wise U.S. guidance, should really decide when a country is ripe for democracy, does it already deserve democracy or not. As to within the United States, his lesson is the same. It is that there is too much populism, popular pressure, so what we need is more power to experts and so on. Now, my point is that he is not even designating a new trend. That's effectively already going on for years. If the first cynicism is for me here that where do we have this democracy now? We have democracy at a certain level of these false, for me, secondary choices. Yes, lifestyles, gay marriages, and so on and so on. But isn't it that already for decades, key questions about monetary politics, globalization, trade agreements, and so on. I mean, nobody votes about that. So I think this is just a signal. That's what I find crucial. About how I hear what I see in all this and some other interesting phenomena. It is a signal of how, that's my, as it were, pessimistic perspective, that I predict that in the years, not even decades to come, the system, I mean simply the global capitalist system at different levels, will have to directly curtail, limit gradually democracy. I think that what we were taking now for granted, it will be slowly taken from us on behalf of this is not a thing to be discussed. It's a neutral knowledge, expert rule, or it's just a matter of security, police, and so on. So I think that what is going on now in the United States is already typical. What is typical, it's not simply emergency state, but it's at the same time emergency state and normal state. It's a strange state where at the same time we are at war, but things go on as normal. And I think that something like that, with all world tensions, will gradually emerge as a normal way of life. I think that we will more and more get this game, or yes, we bring you democracy, but we will decide when you are ripe for democracy. And I think that this is not necessarily only a bad thing, in the sense that the system, if I may use this old-fashioned left term, the system will be more and more obliged to break its own rules. And this will more and more open up a space for some leftist contestation, which will be able to, how to put it, to catch, or what's the English expression, to catch the system at its own work, you know, to measure it by its own standards. So it will not be just we leftists from our loony outside perspectives are making an exquisite Marxist analysis of the falsity of liberal democracy. Is that we will just have to show how liberal democrats, in the sense of official ideology of liberal democracy, is violating its own rules more and more.
If we reject or criticize the standard notion of democracy, what are we advocating? Or if, in the Leninist sense, what are the slogans? What do we put in this place?
First, I don't like to bluff. That is to say, I always like to emphasize that I don't have a clear-cut answer. Where I disagree with many of my friends is that, this is a very sad position, I know, but where I disagree is that I see, as much as I admire the anti-so-called, I'm well aware that it's a false name, but the so-called anti-globalist movement, I fully endorse it as a kind of form of resistance. And I think that the big result of it is that what for me was the lowest point of the left, this multiple struggles ideology of, you know, the big fundamental struggle against capitalism is over. We have just now a multiplicity of particular struggles, gay struggle, ethnic minority struggle, and so on and so on. It's more or less over. Now, it does reemerge again and again that nonetheless all these particular struggles are part of, have to be conceived as in some way subordinated to the big struggle against, okay, now it depends how far do we go, but generally global capitalism today. So this is, I think, big. The big result of this shift. However, the problem that I have with anti-globalism is a very naive one even. It's, of course, it works the way it works now when they emphasize decentralization and so on and so on. It works as the form of resistance. The problem is this enough? Now, I don't have a simple Leninist solution here in the sense of this is just anarchic opposition, we need a big revolutionary party to unite all the forces with a clear program. I know that this is madness. But what I'm also saying is that this logic of resistance has its limits. And I see these limits at what level? For example, let's take someone whom I otherwise admire as a journalist, someone like Naomi Klein, in her celebrations Zapatistas of Puerto Alegre and so on. She's so fascinated with this multiplicity of struggles, no unifying party line and so on and so on. But again, this works as a form of resistance because I see in her reports of all this, from all these battlefields, one problem. She, of course, is intelligent enough to observe all the time how, in order to solve today's problems, we cannot really remain at the local level, like for ecology, not only ecology, even for the normal functioning of economy. You have to have some central authority to regulate things and so on and so on. But I don't think that anti-globalists have a clear answer to this one. Like, to put it in extremely naive terms, how would anti-globalism in power look? Whenever I meet my friends from anti-globalist left. Like recently, I had a very friendly discussion with Michael Hart at Duke. When I ask him this question, he evokes either forms of resistance, which are simply still precisely forms of resistance. But you know, it's easy to be all together in a line when we are just against, or he evokes examples which, if anything, are for me relatively dubious. For example, with all my sympathies for General Chavez in Venezuela. But, you know, the way he functions, there is a clear reference to Latino American tradition of this, of Caudillo and so on and so on. So at this level, I think that we are still searching for a solution. I don't have it. I just think we should be at least honest enough to recognize the deadlock here. And I don't know, from what I know from you, Doug, that you would opt here, maybe, at least in this stage. Nonetheless, we shouldn't write off state as simple as that. Because now I come to my second state apparatuses. Now I come to my second key point. What I find so dangerous in this celebration of local resistances and so on and so on, is that in a strange way, this is also the predominant rhetoric of today's late capitalism itself, the official ideology. I'm well aware of all the paradoxes, which is that although officially Bush, already Reagan, were elected as against big state, but I don't think the state apparatus was at any point in the entire history of the United States, I'm even tempted to say of the world, stronger than it is now precisely in the United States. But nonetheless, when I hear, for example, when in the last book by Naomi Klein, when I read all these slogans, multiplicity, decentralization, local inventiveness, creativity, my God, it's as if I was reading some kind of new capitalist manual. Maybe we should admit that this clear-cut opposition, centralization versus local dispersed powers, is not only politically neutral, but often it can work even in the other way around, so that we should adopt the attitude of centralized power. I mean, I think that we should really get rid of this old leftist prejudice of we are the local civil society, multiple network against the big bad state. I think it's much more complex today. I think this is maybe one big prejudice to be get rid of. Of course, this does not imply to simply endorsing the old welfare state model. Just we should be deeply, deeply aware of how, this is a nice dialectical observation, how the very multiplicity, all this multiple market and other competing forces, in order for them to function, the field where multiplicities can thrive is not given from God. It has to be guaranteed, sustained by an extremely complex network of state apparatuses, regulations, and so on and so on. And that it's not simply multiplicity or not, it's who will regulate it.
Actually, and I interviewed Naomi Klein on this show a few weeks ago. She had said, she was complaining that the anti-globalization movement, whatever you call it, in a state of arrested adolescence because of its fear of power and its fear of an agenda,
that's
and its fear of politics.
I'm speaking with the philosopher and cultural theorist Slavoj Žižek. Now back to the interview.
Let me change the subject a bit. In an article in the London Review of Books, Perry Anderson wondering why the Bush mobilization on Iraq had attracted such a large peace movement, such a large anti-war movement. He thought that there are many, many similarities between what he was planning in Iraq and what the U.S. had done in the past, and didn't understand why suddenly things were perceived as different and why it had encouraged all this popular opposition. And he attributed it perhaps in part to a cultural antipathy against the Bush administration. Now, I think cultural antipathy to the Bush administration is a very good thing, and I'm very much in favor of it. But what do you think of Perry Anderson's critique, and why do you think there is something different about what the Bush administration plans and what they did in Iraq and what their longer-term plans are? Or is it really pretty much continuous with what the U.S. had done in the past?
No. I do believe here, and this is connected with what I started, with this shift in legitimization, because I do believe that there is a break here. I don't find this difference as mysterious as it may seem, because people simply at a very naive level, as it were, at the level of their gut feelings. No, not that anyone thinks that, or at least a large majority, that there's anything good about Saddam regime. And I very much in Iraq, I very much also support the line of reasoning which goes into that. The true question is that all the accusations now against Saddam, all those facts were known to the U.S. administration, you know, the standard line of reasoning, while the United States were still fully supporting Saddam against Iran. So the point is here.
The relation goes back to 1959. With
Even worse. So, I mean, but it's not enough even this hypocrisy. I think that there are two things here. First, at a naive level, there is, to use this old Stalinist dialectic materialist term, a kind of a jump, clear jump of quantity into quality. You can play these games of U.S. interest, geopolitical interest, but nonetheless, when, to the horror of many leftists, even I did show some understanding for the NATO bombing of ex-Yugoslavia, it was for two reasons. Let me be very clear here. First, what bothers me with many leftists is that their, at least implicit, total ignorance for the concrete suffering of the people down there. For example, I was shocked how many of my friends only saw, oh, Americans are bombing Yugoslavia and so on. But were they aware that whatever it was, sorry, but this bombing did stop a terrible conflict. I mean, I'm here very realistic. I respect ordinary people and their worries. But with all this, although there were interests and so on and so on, there were two key differences. First, that at least some kind of humanitarian effect, how should I call it, was perceivable, and even more important, that people, even if they are naive liberals and so on, were somehow aware that any such action does have to have some kind of international legitimacy. What happened in between, was first a whole series of shifts which threw things into a different perspective. One of the key events here for me is, of course, don't underestimate how, although it may appear just a minor judicial struggle, it inscribed itself into people's consciousness. In Europe, this was a mega shock. American arrogant dismissal of the Hague International Court. I don't have any legal illusions here. But this is for me the first big difference, that Gulf War, NATO bombing, and so on, at least you can sell it with all the undercurrent of economic, geopolitical interests. You can sell it as broad international coalition versus some kind of a bad guy. And then even if you were a leftist, you can still say, okay, all the imperialist investments, but nonetheless, so what? We will get rid of one bad guy, so what? But here, this no longer worked. The way United States wanted to do it alone, the way it was absolutely clear already before the war, that all the official justifications simply do not work. Even United States themselves admitted that there is no clear connection with Al-Qaeda, the mythical status of these weapons of mass destruction, and so on and so on. So I think that the gap became so palpable, and I think that this gap connected with the crucial fact that we are now in some kind of a open process where the rules of the new international game are still in formation. And I think that apart, again, from the clear fact that the justification doesn't work, people were somehow aware that it's not only or above all Iraq which is at stake here. Because the usual attitude of many of my friends, even those who are not leftist, is, okay, if you abstract it and you will say just Iraq, what do I care? I would say it's the duty of the United States to get rid of Saddam since they co-created it, no? But the problem is not that. The problem is the new logic of international relations and so on and so on and so on that will emerge with it. I don't think you have to bring in all that cultural aspect, although at the cultural level, things are also, as already developed in some of my texts, interesting in the sense that, at least in my part of ex-communist Eastern Europe, the typical attitude of many who support now the United States is what I ironically refer to as pro-Bush anti-Americanism. That is to say, the very people who otherwise hate American culture, as you know, gay, promiscuous, in conflict with Christian values, too hedonistic, and so on, they support Bush here. So the very same people who warn against Disneyfication, consumption culture, Hollywood, primitivism, and so on, they support Bush here. So this is an interesting phenomenon, which I think for us from Europe, it's important to bear it in mind, because it kind of protects us from cheap America bashing.
You had also written somewhere recently that that Bush's target was at least in part the emancipatory possibilities of American society itself.
I exaggerated it a little bit, but still, I think that you simply cannot also discount that factor. And my point is not some kind of naive old Marxist theory that Bush will use this as an excuse to introduce some kind of half-military dictatorship here. No, what I'm only saying is that I read signs here and there how these imperceptible, unwritten rules of social life, political life, social life are changing gradually. How simply, my eternal example, kind of a Trump card, is here torture. Can you even imagine the topic of torture, of should-be torture prisoners, being considered as a legitimate topic 2-3 years ago? If 2-3 years ago somebody were to write this publicly, it would have been only some right-wing lunatics and so on. My big worry, here I may be a naive old-style Marxist, but my biggest worry is not what happens out there in Iraq, but how in some of my late writing, soft revolution. That is to say, all these imperceptible changes in normativity, in unwritten rules of what is permissible, what is acceptable, what is non-acceptable, I see the true danger at this level.
I'm speaking with the political philosopher and psychoanalyst, Slavoj Žižek. My name is Doug Henwood, the program Behind the News on WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM on the radio dial, and at WBAI.org on the web. And be sure to check out that website. It's all upgraded and looking quite snazzy. And now this word from a band Slavoj Žižek was associated with in the late 1980s and early 1990s, Laibach. Laibach is the German name for Ljubljana and was chosen as a provocation to annoy the nationalists who were plaguing Yugoslavia as it was breaking up. Their strategy, as Žižek explains it in a film about the band, was to use exaggerated fascist and Stalinist imagery to expose the hidden underside of those nationalisms, and by doing so, damage their reputations. Here's a bit from the song Wirtschaft ist tot, Economy is Dead in German, from their album Capital with a K. That was Laibach, an excerpt from Wirtschaft ist tot, German for economy is dead. And now the second part of my interview with the philosopher and cultural theorist Slavoj Žižek.
A very large portion of the American population, 50, 60, 70% in some polls, believes that Saddam was behind September 11th. Only about 17% of the respondents to one poll could correctly say that there were no Iraqis among the hijackers on September 11th. Now, these are clearly false views, fantasy views. first of all, where do you think these sorts of things come from? And second of all, I mean, there's a tendency in a lot of left-thinking writing in America to think that all you need to do is get the facts out there and things will take care of themselves, that all you have to do is correct this misimpression and then people, everything will become clear. I mean, what is the role of these sort of fantasies in politics, and how do you counter them?
Now, that's a good, deep question, deep in the sense that I don't have good answers to it. All I can do is to reformulate in my terms, but maybe this will bring us somewhere, your question. Yes, it is true, and it is here that I, with all my admiration for Noam Chomsky, partially disagree with him. I think that it is as if a kind of an underlying premise of Chomsky's work that, you know, you don't have to do even any big theory. Just tell all the facts to the people and that this will have an enlightening effect. I think that the way ideology works today, it's much more mysterious. Not simply that it's more complex. One can always say this. Things are always more complex, and it means nothing just to say this. No, but simply that I think that one counterfactor is that, in quite naive terms, I think people don't want to know too much. I think there is a kind of a active refusal to know. I think that if you ask an average citizen with enough of his or her own their own worries, they would say, don't even tell me this. The government is there, we pay enough taxes so that we know, so that we can count of them to do the dirty things, and I don't even want to know them. So I think that the primary attitude of people is that in as long as they are not involved, as long as they can be, in their view, reasonably sure that these dirty acts of state secret measures, that these acts do not concern them. They even actively do not want to know. Point two is that I don't even think that that the question is of any real link between Al-Qaeda and Iraqi regime. I remember some debates when on TV, when some viewers' calls made their point clear, which is, we are not talking about empirical links. Both Saddam and Al-Qaeda hate United States. They hate our way of life. That's enough of a link. So then you cannot really help it here if you make these factual statements about are there links and so on and so on and so on. Again, the problem here, the whole series of assumptions of how ideology works. And again, my point is not simply a standard point advocated by some disciples of Deleuze and Guattari that ideology is not just a cognitive process, that you have all these emotional, libidinal, affective investments. My point would be what I already said, that even at the cognitive level, the investments are much more contradictory, that the key factor is not so much that people are duped as that there is an active will not to know. And this was for me a big lesson already, if you remember, with Reagan presidency, where you may well remember how after every speech or press conference, there were very few of them, he was tightly controlled of Ronald Reagan. This was a big joke then, next day, in all liberal, inclusive New York Times newspapers, to make the whole list of where he was wrong, the factual mistakes. The big surprise was that this only raised his popularity. This was the point of identification and so on. So far from undermining his popularity, it raised his popularity.
So also with Bush, too, people argue that his ignorance was part of his appeal.
Yeah, although I think that here, up to a point, September 11th, I think, changed the situation very much. I think that before September 11th, I don't think to what extent people would have swallowed him, as it were. I think this is really the part of it. And I really think that the Bush presidency, the younger Bush, present one, is a kind of ideal image. You have a naive, unknowing, if unknowing, president, and then you have this sinister figure of knowledge like Dick Cheney, who is the operative guy who really controls him. I think this is quite a nice metaphor for how things work.
Why would that metaphor have appeal?
Because I think that this is how people like to identify themselves. I can be stupid, but I'm still at the top. The wise guy is my vice. He's doing all the dirty job for me, as it were. There is something appealing in this, I think. Now, again, my basic presupposition is drop the point that people want to know. People don't want to know. No, I'm not engaged in any conservative psychology of, you know, people prefer ignorance, so it's only for us, revolutionary or spiritual elite, to lead them. I'm not saying this is an eternal fact. I'm just describing how specifically today's ideology works. Through this, how should I put it, direct appeal to the will of ignorance. With this, you know, they don't argue at the level this is not true. It's a much more conscious, I wouldn't even say cynical attitude, because again, now we come to the ultimate complexity here. This is the complex, the true complexity, not the fake one, of ideology. Let me approach it from the zero level. Recently, I reread again Hitler's Mein Kampf with a very naive focus of my reading. My focus of rereading the book, an extremely boring book, incidentally repetitive, blah, blah, was, did Hitler believe it in his own racist, blah, blah, or not? And there is an absolutely necessary conclusion, yes and no at the same time. You can see him consciously manipulating, as it were, displaying his formula. For example, when he says, in order to seduce people, you have to give them a simplified target, enemy, repeat it again and again. But then, 3 pages later, you see him, as it were, caught in his own game. This only, again, makes it clear how much more, not so much more complex, but simply in how much more inconsistent, different way ideology functions.
So what do radical leftists do in the face of this embrace of ignorance? Do we try to challenge it or try to work with it, try to work around it, ignore it?
No. I am still here, how should I call it, naive, enlightened person. That is to say, one should challenge it. Just one should challenge it without illusions. That is to say, again, I'm here in a very tragic predicament. I don't like to bluff. I'm not saying that I have clear answers and the blueprint for what to do today. My remaining hope is a very sad, pessimistic hope. It is that maybe we cannot do a lot now, but what also many conservatives got it, that the ruling system of ideology created such high democratic expectations that it cannot live up to them, and that, again, gradually it will have to violate them, so that in this sense, if I combine this necessary disappointment, because, you know, once people are given certain rights, even if they are purely ideological, it's difficult to take these rights from them. I don't think it will be easy to discipline people and to say, no, we promised you too much, we cannot do it, and so on and so on. So if you combine this with what I do see as a clear perspective of future economic upheavals and so on, I think that, my worry is not the worry of many of my leftist friends, like, why are you dreaming about revolutions, the system will just go on. No, I'm almost tempted to say unfortunately, because, you know, I know that unstable pre-revolutionary situations, let's be frank, they are not a kind of holiday of history. You know, they can be very unpleasant thing. It's not so nice to live in uncertain times. But they will compel us to invent new political forms. My answer is, it's not a question the system will just go on, nobody needs a revolution. My point is that in a couple of years, the way I see it with my limited knowledge of the situation, we will be literally compelled, forced, to reinvent new ways.
There are people like David Harvey who argue that the reason that Bush is pursuing this ambitious imperial agenda, and it's interesting now that pundits and ideologues have begun using this word imperial in a positive way and very openly.
Yeah, that's the surprise.
But this
incidentally is my surprise, if I may interrupt. Yes. This is, I think, an intelligent move from them, and we, the left, should learn from that. How the best strategy, if you can risk it, you cannot do it with everything. When people accuse you of being a murderer, you know, you cannot say proudly, yes, I am a murderer. But as much as possible, this is always the most effective and disarming the opponent ideological gesture. Accused of imperialism, you probably say, yes, of course, but that's the point, I am that. I almost admire them for that. That's intelligent. That's the most dangerous tactic. Not the tactic of bad conscience, no, I'm not really that, and so on. Sorry, I interrupted.
I'm speaking with the philosopher and cultural theorist, Slavoj Žižek. Now back to the interview.
you go.
But yeah, okay. Harvey and others have argued that, that this is, in some sense, a compensation for growing economic weakness in the United States, and this is an attempt to assert through military and political power what is being lost in the economic realm, and that this is really a response to some conscious or unconscious recognition of an American ideal, American economic crisis. What do you think of that?
Possible, but maybe up to a certain point, it's also. I would just add 2 points, but here you, as an economist, you who really know about this thing, should be able to fill in my gaps and to help me. First, I would say that, now, I'm here talking about elementary knowledge, so you should correct me, but isn't it that up to a point we are encountering the same paradox visible all around in the last 2 decades? You remember the good old days when Democrats were spending money and Republicans were preaching tight fiscal policy and so on. Now we really live in crazy times where Democrats introduce a balanced budget and so on, and Republicans are the worst New Dealers. No, I mean, because it happened, I think, already with Reagan. You remember how, unfortunately, we are both old enough to remember this. You remember how, when he was elected, it was with this usual Washington bashing, you know, big bad government. But my God, he tripled, quadrupled, whatever, the national debt, and so on and so on. What effectively Reagan did was the old-fashioned, this New Deal spending, and so on and so on. And isn't at a certain level now, Bush the second, doing the same. So what I'm saying is that it's not only that this is meant as a kind of a displacement, like economy is going back, so let's make a war to make headlines. Isn't it that at the same time they expect from this war, a new economic boom, not in the simple sense of this old Marxist paranoiac sense of companies dealing with war products will profit, although now we clearly have example, like shameless examples of this. But isn't the idea that, for example, through occupation of Iraq, the oil sources, the oil supply will be more controlled, one threat of inflation less, and so on and so on. So they are counting on immediate benefits. Point two is that although United States may be in a crisis, but from my, again, limited knowledge, but isn't so the whole world? Isn't on average United States nonetheless a little bit less in the crisis than, let's say, Western Europe? It's easy to get involved in this comparative analysis and claiming how Western Europe still has this welfare state model and it's simply another type of capitalism than the Anglo-American capitalism. But nonetheless, I don't see, maybe you see it from my limited knowledge, against a positive, assertive alternative to the more and more expanding American model of capitalism, which would work. And it can work in 2 ways. Either you accept the Blair third way logic, which is we can accept global rules of globalization, but still maintain some elements of social policy and so on and so on, or in a more radical sense, to take the crazy risk and to say, let's simply break the rules of what are supposed to be today the non-political rules of how you run economy, and to make again this crazy wager that you will not be forced into collapse. And the tragedy that I see is not simply that of rhetorics. What do I mean by this? Some of my leftist friends, like Ernesto Laclau, they present this almost as a pure problem of rhetorics. For example, if you read Ernesto Laclau, his claim is that while the new right is strong in this hegemonic rhetoric, the new right does have at least a positive vision, that the left is simply adopting a defensive moralist attitude. Yeah, but it's adopting this attitude because it actually does not have a, you know, it's not just a problem of rhetorics. I mean, what should the left do? In the long term, I'm an optimistic pessimist. By this, I mean, I have a hope for change because of my very pessimism. Because I think that the crisis is coming. But at a certain level, now I will say something horrible if there are leftists among the people who listen to us. But I mean this as precisely an honest leftist position. I'm getting tired of my leftists in England especially, friends who play this eternal anti-third way, anti-Blair game. Why? Because their implicit supposition is simply, if only Blair or Schröder, the new West European third way social democracy, if only their were not their betrayal of the old social democracy. If they were to stick to old welfare state, then everything would be okay. But I think simply because of the changes in capitalism and so on, that model, at least in that form, simply does not work. And in a certain way, not that I agree with them, I am absolutely opposed to third wave social democracy, but in a way, I admire at a certain level what, okay, may sound cynical, I would call they're honest. You know, they made it clear, as some guys around Blair said, in economics we are now all like Margaret Thatcher and so on. That's no longer the battlefield. I don't agree with that, but at least I like guys who honestly admit this, better than to sticking to some alternatives which are clearly fake alternatives, which mean nothing. Like, for example, this Trotsky dreams of, you know, if only Trotsky, if only Lenin were to survive for 2 years and made a pact with Trotsky, everything would have been different. And for me, what these guys are claiming now, if only European social democracy were to remain faithful to its roots, all would... No, the first step towards recovery is to admit the depth of defeat and to drop these crazy illusions.
What did you make of the opposition on the part of Germany and France to the American war effort? Was this the dying gasp of a displaced junior imperialism, or was this the birth of some kind of EU alternative to American power?
My very naive analysis would have been that this dilemma that you presented is inscribed into the very situation. It's both. On the one hand, yes, there definitely is this imperial aspect within Europe of Germany and France. It's clear that they were worried by this expansion of European Union, and they wanted to play a leading role there, and they did it even in a very bad, arrogant way. Also, I don't think we should have any illusions, especially about France, what France did in Rwanda. Everyone knows, speaking with numerous diplomats, not American, Europeans, they admitted that, you know, that Rwanda massacre a couple of years ago, that was pure France, pure Mitterrand, if anything, no? Then what French are doing, for example, through some of my friends, I know Congo, Brazzaville. My God, if the notion of neo-post-colonialist state has any meaning at all today, it's worse than even Latino American banana republics, it's Congo Brazzaville today. It's Alpha Kitten, the big French oil company, which incidentally, historically, had much better relations with Socialist Party. It's owning the country. It's interested only in controlling the small piece of land close to the sea where the oil reserves are, and to bribe the ruling clique, while the large majority of the country is, as to the state of its infrastructure, below the level of 40 years ago when it was still a colony. So no idealization of France. And of course, it was also a kind of a fake. But you know, when people, on the other hand, I think that that's the basic historical dialectic, that things which start as a kind of a narcissistic or interested or hurt big power feeling, things which may explode and emerge for the wrong reason, can in the long term start to function on its own. Like, it may have began like that, but nonetheless, it did start a certain movement which was in itself good. I don't think that if we say, okay, much of Europe was against United States, but now we should look at the true roots and then you dismiss it. No, I don't think this is the truth of it. There was a resistance which is in itself positive. Point two, even when people complain, but this was a weak resistance, now it's vanishing, now already Chirac is practically withdrawing and so on, how Europe really showed its weakness. Oh, but I would say, are people aware how precisely by experiencing this as Europe's defeat, you at least set certain standards, you become in a negative way aware of what should have been done. My parallel here is with feminism. The first step of feminism is not women should win, is that you become aware of how impotent, defeated women are. You know, the first step towards liberation is in a way the awareness of defeat. Along the same lines, I think this is very good if we become aware of how Europe failed. But you know, if Europe failed, then it failed to do something that we at least know we should have done, and there will be other chances, and so on and so on. So, in the same way that I didn't have any big illusions 2-3 months ago that this would already be the start of the big anti-American coalition, whatever. I am now not such a pessimist. Isn't this a good thing that at least Europe is aware of its failure? That it's clearly aware of its failure.
We also saw in the run-up to the war the emergence very rapidly of a very large, globally coordinated anti-war movement that was in no small part an anti-imperialist movement. Why do you think it arose so quickly? And do you think it's going to continue beyond that? Is it going to grow into a real anti-imperialist movement? Or is it now been shattered by the results of the war in Iraq?
Of course, now it's temporarily shattered. The reasons it grew is precisely what we were talking already at the beginning of our talk. That is to say, I think that more than this cultural unease at Bush, it's the fact that people are somehow aware that more is at stake here than Iraq. That a whole new implicit rules of international order, which are pretty catastrophic if you universalize them, are emerging. I think that was the key. And second point, I do think more and more that, of course, now there will be a backlash and so on and so on. But you know, the logic of progressive movements is always from defeat to defeat up to the final victory. That is to say, there will be a next crisis, it will be better organized and so on and so on. Just think the other way around. About 2 years ago or more, who would have expected such an explosion? I mean, it was incredible. These were, if I remember it correctly, in United Kingdom and so on, these were the largest political demonstrations in their entire history. I think that, of course, now we have this deceptive moment of triumph, but wait a couple of months, where, as I said at the beginning, for structural reasons, America, of course, I'm not even too pessimistic here, I think that in the short term it may work. Of course, they will introduce some market freedoms, freedom of the press. I even give them a fair chance to succeed for a couple of years. But there will be other tensions with other countries, probably renewed terror attacks. You know, the situation is so predictable that even if it will relatively work in Iraq, by the very logic of their intervention, they will be pushed into, shall we swallow even Syria with it, and so on, further and further. The situation will get out of hand, and this will, I'm sure, trigger new protests, and so on and so on. So no, I think that, again, as I wrote in one of my articles, what I'm really afraid of, and many, I took this idea from other more intelligent political analysts than me, is that when we left-wingers, in a first naive analysis, when we were pointing out, but is America aware that in this way they are only expanding, creating new tension there? Well, I agree with those who draw attention to the possibility, but what if they are aware of this? What if the aim is to introduce instability to the entire region and then to brutally impose through kind of universalized emergency state, new order? But so I think they are aware of this, the United States, but the limit of their intervention was shown clearly already in Afghanistan, because to be slightly cynical, where are we now? The disorder is much larger than under Taliban. The only clear success of Afghanistan occupation is, as far as I can tell, economic one, in the sense that Afghanistan is now again fully integrated into world market, if I'm correctly informed, producing between 70% and 80% of opium. No, again. That's, I think, the only clear free market rate result of that one. Otherwise, from what I know, at the level of daily lives, state organization. Okay, you can play this cheap CNN journalistic game and say, you see, there are cyber cafes popping up in Kabul or whatever, no? But basically, the state doesn't exist, how should I put it, in Afghanistan. So I think that even if in Iraq it may work, it's more universal, a little bit better, but it's so ridden with antagonisms of explosions. Let's recall the whole problem of Kurds, Turkey, and so on, what Turkey is not ready to allow, all that stuff. I think that in the long term, United States, even if they are consciously counting on the global disorder there, they will not be able to control it. And my only hope is that American intervention and possible future interventions, this is for me the crucial moment. All this influential will give rise to some kind of resistance. My big hope, I, as it were, as an atheist, pray night and day for it, is that this resistance will not be simply kidnapped by the so-called fundamentalists. That it will, this resistance will have at least a, how should we call it, secular socialist wing. And I think there is a fair chance at it. Like, if we read it together with what is going now on in Iran and so on and so on, there is hope.
And that was Slavoj Žižek, the cultural theorist and philosopher, in an interview recorded last Sunday. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Back to a more normal show next week. And let's go out with another bit from Laibach, the band that Žižek was associated with 10 to 15 years ago. This is their version of Get Back from their song-by-song cover of the Beatles' Let It Be. And then stay tuned for the news. Till next week, goodbye.
Left his home in Tucson, Arizona, Fort Sac, California.